chapter 6 this morning, verse 1. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth, thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself. When thou art come into the hand of thy friend, go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Now in this first admonition, we see just a very down-to-earth practical truth. And yet it's a truth that many Christians really need to know and need to learn. It sounds like a little hard, a little bit maybe withdrawn, a little stingy perhaps, a little bit like shutting the bowels of compassion. But really, I think it's wisdom. And I think anyone who's traveled this way very long knows that it's true. Now, what he's talking about here is he's warning against being a surety for a friend. In the days of Moses, God said that if a brother has need, and he's just you, and he has need, why loan him, he's your brother, and don't take any interest from him. But if a stranger, a non-Israelite, comes in, he wants to borrow any money from you, or borrow something from you, take interest. He's not your brother. You don't owe to just borrow from him because he wants. You can make this your livelihood. You can gain something by it. That's all right. But in the days of, when it came to the days of King Solomon, at the time this was written, commerce had sprung all over the face of the that part of the earth, and it no longer was a camp of Israel and close brothers and sisters all intermarrying with us in the same church and so forth. But now they were getting gold from opal from the islands off of India and peacocks from India and they were getting leopard skins from Ethiopia and ivory from Africa, and they were getting things from all over the face of the earth. The traders were making a great deal of money, and it had come to a place where it became very profitable to lend, to be a money lender. The money lenders were getting rich, you know, and the money lenders today are getting rich. But when they wanted to lend money to somebody and charge interest, of course, they had to make sure that they had some kind of security. But oftentimes a person wanted to borrow more than he had security for, because he had money coming on a ship of grain from Egypt, but he didn't have any enough to back up what he needed to borrow for right now. And so the money lenders would then go to you'd have to find someone for surety. You'd have to find somebody else who had enough possessions, who would underwrite it, who would sign for him, co-sign for him, so to speak. And this is what he means by being a surety. The money lenders not only found they could make money by lending, but they found that they could make money by repossessing. They would take several 100% more. They would take goods worth several 100% more than what they're loaning. And then if he couldn't make it, they would get a lot more than they ever get by the interest. And then if they couldn't get it from him, they'd get it from a friend who would co-sign for him. This practice lost a lot of friends and made a lot of heartache and a lot of slavery and reduced a lot of people to poverty, caused a lot of problems. It's a very dangerous practice. A person feels obligated to underwrite for his friend. His friend is so positive he's going to get the money. He's so positive he's going to pay back. It's such a sure deal. And he's so convincing. And he is your friend. And he needs it. The money now, for some reason. And it won't be very long when you'll get yours back. And he may even add a little bit to yours when you get it back for being such a good friend. And he's such a smile on his face. And it's hard to tune him down, because then he feels you can co-sign for him, and by refusing to co-sign, you kind of think, I don't trust you, and that's kind of a slap in his face. And so there's an obligation, so you give. But then the next thing you know, it doesn't come to pass. Next thing you know, the ship comes in, and you've got a paper right in your hand showing that it's going to come in for you. Right here it says that you own that, and on the market, right, it can make so much more money. And the ship has already left Alexandria, and it's good sailing weather, and there's not even a chance of a storm or a problem. And just no problem. But when the ship gets there, you find out that the pilots took the treasure on the high seas. And he hadn't figured on that. And next thing you know, the moneylender says, where's the security? And he says, well, I didn't have any, so my friend co-signed. They go to the friend's house and says, all right, I want your house. Here's your security. Your house. Your children have to go into slavery. And want all your goods. And all of a sudden, that person's pretty upset. He never figured on that. He never figured on having to sell his house and his children. That was only paperwork, because the other was a positive deal. So next thing you know, he's over pounding in the middle of the night in the neighbor's house with his fist, his friend, I mean what used to be his friend, and his friend answers the door, and ashen facing, and he doesn't really want to see him, you know. Maybe he's even moved, maybe he doesn't even answer the door. But if he answers the door, next thing you know, a big argument ensues. Look what you've done to me. You promised me. Well, I didn't know the pilots were going to take the ship. And see what's happened? And he lost a friend, but he reduced him to slavery. And so he says, now be careful about being a surety for a friend. It's a dangerous practice. Now you look in the book of Genesis, chapter 42. Let's look at a man clear back hill that decided to be a surety, that volunteered it. He wasn't asked, he volunteered it. He didn't get into trouble by it, but he sure could have. Genesis 42:37. And here we find that Joseph was down in Egypt, now second to the highest of the Pharaoh, but nobody knew it yet. Back in the land where Israel lived, and all he had left was Benjamin, and his sons had come back from Egypt, talking with Joseph, did not know it was him yet, and they weren't going to do anything until show them any favor and get them out of the jam unless Benjamin came down. And so they were asking Israel to give up Benjamin for a while. And Reuben spake to his father said, in verse 36, Jacob their father said to them, me have ye bereaved of my children, Joseph is not. I've lost my son Joseph, and Simeon is not, because he was kept down there as a surety, and ye will take Benjamin away? All these things are against me. And Reuben spake to his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. Now, that was a very dangerous surety. I'll give you my two sons. And if I don't bring Benjamin back again, kill my two sons. That was a pretty dangerous surety, wasn't it? He couldn't promise to bring Benjamin back again. Oh, he could promise, but I mean, he had no surety of it. How did he know he could bring Benjamin back again? What if the magistrate there in Egypt decided that he wasn't going to let Benjamin go and pull another trick on him? Then what would he do? He'd lose his two sons. Supposing Benjamin got hijacked along the way, or got sick and died. There he was putting his two sons on the block. Now, I have a sneaking hunch, however, that this is a little modified by the fact that he knew his father wouldn't do it. It's easier to make these, you know, all right, go ahead and you can take, you know, but you know he won't.
but hopefully a little bit more magnanimous. And then in chapter 43 in verse 9, I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. Now, see, they already had an understanding of heart that, well, forget it, son. You know I'm not going to kill your two boys. So I'm not going to kill my two grandsons. I love them almost like you do. So here he plays another surety game. I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. Son, I don't want to be blamed forever. I want my son Benjamin. So you can blame me. That's not a very good trade. It's a dangerous practice. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 6. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, now, you see, this friend may be a creditor, or he may be a friend, but somewhat of a stranger. And if you've stricken your hand with him, that means if you've shaken hands and agreed on it. In those days, they didn't have the Western custom of grasping the hand and clumping it up and down. They had the hand, if a merchant and him agreed, they'd both reach in quickly and pop their hands together. They just, it's okay, agree on it. And they'd pop their hands together, and that's an agreement. Same as shaking hands. So if you've stricken your hand with a stranger, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth. Because you see, first of all, you make an agreement with your mouth, and then you ratify it by the stricken of hands. So it is the words of your mouth, the conditions of the contract, have snared you. If you've made that agreement and you put yourself as a surety, you have been snared. You've been taken in a trap. Thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Because now you're in a place of bondage. You're no longer a free man. There's a sword of Damocles hanging over your head by a thin cord. And if things don't go out right, you may be reduced to slavery. Right, verse 3. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself. For now it cometh the hand of thy friend. Go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. In other words, prevail upon him to take the whole liability upon himself. He's the one who is responsible. He's the one who's doing it, not you. You go to him, and you humble yourself. Get down on your knees, if necessary. You make a case out of it. You humble yourself. Don't try to hold your back. I've always said so. Now, you go back and untune the thing. Get it turned back around right, and do whatever necessary and prevail on him until he finally agrees to take the whole responsibility upon himself. Well, it belongs, because it's his transaction. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Don't waste any time. Let it happen during the night, or before nightfall. Get with it right now, and get the job taken care of, and don't sleep until you get taken care of. You're in bondage right now. Deliver thyself as a roll from the hand of the hunter. In other words, here's a roe, and he's running. Run like a roe does when he's being hunted. Leave surety. Being a surety for someone like this. And as a bird from the hand of the fowler. And you grab a bird and he picks that hand, he makes a fuss until he gets free. He picks that hand, he won't let you go until he gets free. And he says, be like that. Just get picking on him until you get loose. Now, you see, once you become surety, the loney often feels little responsibility. The spirit of exertion becomes crippled and listless in him. You see, if he's going to lose his own house, his own wife and family, he works hard. I mean, he gets out and he digs. But all of a sudden, when the load's off of him, it's on somebody else. Listen, you know, he's laying on his back. And you pass by and you're working hard. You say, how come you're not working? Oh, it'll come in. I got a good deal next week. It's coming by. See? All of a sudden, he's not digging any longer. There's no anxiety. It's all been passed over to you. You got the anxiety. But he's the one who's going to get the money. And you got the anxiety. You got the worries, and you're in the bondage. You didn't under any bondage, because you didn't think I'd lose a thing. It's all the bondage under you. You got the worries, the ulcers, and the bondage, the potential slave. He didn't have anything. And he's the one who got the money. Why should you do that? Make people responsible for themselves. That's what's teaching. I think there's a lot of truth in this. This is a common fault, especially among new converts that love everybody so much, and we're just so naive, they want to become surety for everybody, just like that. You see, there's no consequence to himself. The admonition that I would give is this. Give what you can, and loan only what you can give. Loan only what you will give. When you loan somebody $10, ask yourself, am I willing to give him $10? If you're willing to give him $10, then loan it to him. Don't give it to him. Giving, usually. Now, there are times when you've got to give and somebody has a need, and there's times when it's all right to give. But more often than not, it's better to loan than to give. Because you develop responsibility in a person when you loan. You only develop in a person when you give, you're always giving to somebody. Pretty soon people, you know, who are always getting, they develop an attitude, well, they think everybody owes them something. And they develop a slothful attitude where they don't work. And if you don't give to them, then they'll hurt at you as though you have some kind of an obligation. They have bad things to you because you haven't given, like you owe them something. You don't owe them a thing. But they get to feel like the world owes them. And they want everybody to give, just give. And they become lazy and slothful, and they lose their integrity. Now, I'm going to tell you something. This won't cost you anything, but some of you may not know it. There's a big myth out about the American Indian in this country. It's been promulgated in the schools, and I don't believe a word of it. They make you to believe that because this country did a terrible deed and took away the happiness of the American Indian, that we now should support him with great piles of money and help and on the reservations to make up for it. That's the biggest lie that I know of in this area. It's absolutely not true at all. First place is, if you go back and try to undo everything that's been done from the beginning of time and to try to give what back to France and back to them and Mexico to give back to this country and France to give back to them and England to give back to France and the Germans to give back, everybody to give back, you're back to the original landowning. I mean, every nation has gone through this interplay from the very beginning, and nobody else is trying to give it all back. Nobody else in the wars are giving everything back. But you find the second myth is, it's the same myth as when people say, the Americans go over and bother the heathens in different lands. They're happy, and we go over them and try to force our way of life on them and get them all miserable and mixed up. The truth of the matter is they're not happy, they're miserable. And I've talked to lots of missionaries. They're miserable. They're living in fear and demon power, and there's no rejoicing, and there's no happiness. I've heard them come back themselves with the missionaries and said, I've never smiled in all my life until I became a Christian. There's no joy. They're in darkness, and they're in misery, and they're in poverty. And when the missionary societies have sent goods to Africa, they've been so thrilled and delighted that they would wear pajamas to church with great glee. They'd wear a woman's corset to church. They'd wear anything. They'd wear half of anything. If a man had three pair of pants out of a missionary belt, he'd wear all three. And he'd roll the cuffs up so you could see all three layers, so he could show you how rich he was. They actually do this now. I have some good authority from the missionaries. One woman went back, she was kind of a heavy set American woman, and she went way back in the tall alcohol grass and threw the old worn-out closet away so everybody would see her. Because she knew how they were like. Next thing you know, the big fat cook came right up the aisle of the church with it on next Sunday morning. And they're so happy to get anything, though. It isn't that they love their life, they're living in squalor because God has not blessed them because they've been in heathenism. And this nation says, well, we're going to bless them anyways. We pour the money to them, and he blesses them that God says, don't bless them, I've cursed them. And we're going to bless them anyway, and we've got a philosophy out in America, we should bless them. You see how twisted we are from what God says? Now, I believe in giving to people without, but there should be strings attached. Before we feed heathens and encourage heathens to live so heathens won't die, so heathens will bring more heathens to bring more heathens, God had in the old covenant, he had to go out and slay them. But we feed them and see how many we can get. And we don't do one thing to bring them out of heathenism. Give them millions and a Christian nation, there's nothing to bring them out of heathenism. Just try to keep heathenism going. And the rats have eaten over half, or the two-thirds or something, of all the wheat ever given to India, but never do a thing to ever solve the problem. Bless them that God has cursed, because we don't believe God's cursed them. God said so, we don't believe it, so we're going to feed them. We think it's just unfortunate circumstances. But that's not the truth. And the American Indian, if you study the American Indian, not from just some from real history, you'll find out that he's lived as a naked savage, eating his own dogs, and hungry, and lived by a squalid, and he wasn't a happy person. This is a myth about these people with nothing being so happy is a myth. And they were more than happy. When the white man came along, look at them. They were so happy to get any of their goods, they couldn't stand it. They raided them. It wasn't all Americans after them. The average American was trying only to sneak through the country and get over to the West Coast before the Indians got to them, hoping and praying that the Indians wouldn't raid them. But no, they wanted their goods so bad. They were barbaric savages that would come down and kill anybody and take life away so they could get their goods. They weren't hurting them. They didn't own that land anyway. I mean, the land was, as far as your eye could see, they left their own land, and they traveled hunting for smoke, hunting for somebody coming through some valley way out there someplace, 8, 9, 10 days away from where they lived, trying to sneak through without getting caught. They hunted them up, and hunted them down, and slayed them. And we got this idea that we've taken their land, and they have been so peaceful and so happy. Then what have we done? We've taken the American Indian, and we've done the worst thing you could ever do to him. We have made him a man of no integrity. We have put him to a place on a reservation where he does not have to work, and we've given him money, and they become drunkards, and they booze all the time and sleep half the time and live in lasciviousness and sin, and they've got no integrity, and they won't work a day in their life. I know a little bit about the American Indian. My father's ministered among them, and Don Moore, I've listened to him by the hour, and he's ministered among the Indian villages all up and down Canada. And he knows the American, he knows the Indians. And unfortunately, not as a race, but America has ruined them. Now you can take any group of people, and you can just give them benevolence, benevolence, and benevolence, and set them up and make not work, and you'll ruin them. There's no integrity. There's no desire to work. There's no earnestness. There's everything's been taken away. It's been taken away. It's a bad thing to ever get to a place where government, big daddy, take care of you, you don't do anything. It reduces people right down to nothing. You see, they tried that in this country when the pilgrims first came to this country and the boat unloaded the goods, and they came here, and the boat sailed off across back to England, and here they were in the facing the big woods, and winter was going to come on, and the Indians were there, and here was a band of pilgrims, and they said, we better band together here, and what if somebody gets sick and can't work? Why, we better band together and all work and put everything in a communal storehouse. And so under Governor Bradford, they put everything in a community storehouse, because And then everybody gets doled out the same. And we all work, we all dole out because he's got more children, he's got more hands, he's got big brothers in his family, and he doesn't. And it sounded good, you see. There's a certain amount of helping in a good spirit. But what happened? They almost starved to death. You know, Luke couldn't work, he had a crick in his back, and Sabbath he had to kill the baby, and the mother had four kids, and grandpa was too old, and all of this, and so the others were working themselves to death to pay for everybody else. Everybody else was sat around. It finally got so bad, the people finally said, we refuse this system, and they finally they decided to change it, and said, okay, those that work eat, and those that don't, you're on your own. And all of a sudden they produced more, and everybody got along. All of a sudden, Luke was out there, was picking his back, and he was hoeing away. And all of a sudden, Samantha, she had the little girl, but she was working there weeding, and the girl was right beside her. And all of a sudden, Grandpa was out there working, and they had food. But see what happens when somebody else can do it? Why do it? And you breed a lazy, indifferent people who won't do anything, and it affects the religion as well. It affects your whole life. We've ruined the American Indian. All we got to do now is say they've got a right. They can get education the same as we. They can get jobs the same as we. Let's start getting them out of that jam we put them in, and let's start making them responsible citizens so that they will be on their own, working. The best thing you can do is get them out of there, get them into a school, let them grow up and get a job and get out on his own, away from the reservation. The reservation will ruin them. But Don Morris says you go out to a reservation, you never have a Sunday morning service. They won't get up before at least noon or 1 o'clock. They sleep all morning long. They won't get up. And they're lazy. You never see them running. Slothful. They drink whiskey all day. They're drunk all the time. Just lay around and just live for alcohol and lay on their back. The place is a mess. They won't clean it up. No, they won't clean it up at all. Won't do anything to clean up. Just leave everything, lay around, and wait for more money to come in from the government. It's ruined the people. That's not the way to help them. We try to help people sometimes. And there are people, we have run across people in our assembly that we try to help them by giving, killing them. Keep killing them. And I finally have to say, quit killing them. They're going to have to get a job. Paul says, I've commanded that they won't work, that they should not eat. We think, oh, I'd be hard on them. Well, it is hard to do it. But they're never going to make it. If you're ever going to make it, you're going to have to find them and grow up. You can't kill your children forever. There comes a day you have to say, all right, let them get out there and get up at the rough and put you to get down to practically nothing. You may have to bait them out on occasion, but you keep in the habit of it all the time. They'll depend on you the rest of their life, and they'll never get out and really do anything. They waste what they've got and never learn to save and never learn to do anything. And this is necessary. And it's good that we learn this. Don't always give. So learn only what you can give and what you will give. And don't be a surety for anything that you can't give or won't give, because you may have to do that. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 8:13. It's a real down-to-earth practical truth, but it's so important because I've seen the problem right here in this assembly. Hearts so big that they get themselves in trouble and ruin somebody by trying to help them. We've had to ask people not to help people anymore. Let them get out and crawl a bit and learn to walk so they can learn to become a responsible citizen. Especially those that come out of hippieism and have just learned to float around and do nothing. There is no man that hath power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit. Pardon me, is this what I want? Let me look a minute. Oh, 8:13. It doesn't look right. Let me see where I am. What do I want here? Can anybody see what I'm looking for? No, I don't know what I mean now. Let's look at Philemon. Philemon 10, I think maybe a good example there. Pardon? Well, I don't believe so. Pardon? And I'll look here. 3:13. Than what I had in mind. There's quite a lot of them fit. Let's look at this other one. I had a scripture, though, that was good the other day that was relevant. All right, let's look at Philemon now, 10. Philemon 10. Just for the book of Hebrews. I beseech thee for my son, Onesimus, whom I have begotten in my bonds, which in times past was to thee unprofitable, but now profitable to thee and to me, whom I have sent again, thou wilt receive him, that is, mine own bowels. In verse 17, if thou count me therefore a partner, receive him as myself. If he hath wronged thee, he oweth thee aught, put that on mine account. Paul, I have written it with mine own hand, I will repay it. Albeit I do not say to thee how thou owest unto me, even thine own self besides. He says, now, Onesimus was unprofitable to you once upon a time. I admit that he came and he was unprofitable to you, and it cost you and all of this. But now he's profitable. Now he's come up spiritually, and now he's going to be someone to do some good. He was pretty young when I brought you before, and he didn't do everything right. And I'll admit this. So if he owes you anything, if he's wronged you, owe it. Why, you put that in my account, and I'll pay for it. So Paul has been willing to make himself a surety for what Onesimus did previously, although Paul rather knows what he's done, and he's quite sure they're not going to take him up on it, but he's willing to do it, and he's willing to pay for it if they'll ask for it. But he wants to bring him. That's a little difference. You see, you don't become a surety of anything that you won't give. Paul was willing to give. But don't become a surety of something that's so over your head and so far it's going to swamp you completely. Because by swearing, you can't make one, by taking an oath, you can't make one black or white, or you can't add a cubit to your statue. You can be so positive something's going to come about, but it may not happen. Many people who are too prudent to get into debt will get into debt for others by being a surety. For somebody who usually needs it because he's not prudent. You've been very careful and prudent all your life, and somebody else, he's been sloppy and slovenly, and so you're careful not to get into debt. So you get into debt by being a surety to him and he doesn't follow through. I had a fellow come, I'm going to look at 1 Timothy 5:22 first, I think. Now this is not speaking exactly the same vein, and yet it has an application. Be not partakers of other men's sins. They cause themselves a problem. They get into a problem. Don't be a partaker of their sins or their problems. I had a fellow come to me, and he'd gotten saved he listened to a message that I preached, and he came to me and said he couldn't resist the call of this message, and he gave his heart to the Lord. And he needed to get to my house, and he needed $30 so he could bring some, I don't want to get too much detail, bring something from a certain place to heal. And I knew he was a bad risk, even though he'd given his heart to the Lord, because I knew that his whole past was slipshod. He was a man who didn't have good habits at all, and he lived this way all the time, always owing somebody, and never paying, always in trouble. Well, I knew that I probably, because of past experiences, I knew that I probably wouldn't get the money back. But I didn't want to leave him without the money, because I knew he needed it. I knew that he really needed to do this. Yet I knew it was his own fault. So I said to him, I didn't see any reason to give him the money without some security, because I don't see any reason not to make him responsible a little bit. And I said, what kind of security? Now my wife thought I could just give it to him and not take anything. What kind of security do you have? He pulled a wristwatch off of his hand and he handed it to me. He says, well, here came my watch. Well, it wasn't worth any more than $30, I'm sure. I didn't demand that he... What you really need to do, in a case like that, is take about $200 worth of his hunting goods and fishing goods and everything else, and then you'll be sure to get the money back, because he is willing to buy it back because it's a good deal for all $200 worth of equipment for $30, see? Then he'll pay you back. So I loaned it to him anyway. He took the watch. Just next week he's going to get the money. I've never had a cent. I said, it's a watch. You see it on occasion. It's on my wrist on occasion. He's been around here for a couple of years. He's never paid me back. No, he's not paying me back. Mm-hmm. He knows he owes it to me. I've mentioned it once, I think, or twice, maybe, and he volunteered on occasion. Some person in the family calls up on occasion, and even occasionally mentions, oh, he'll pay that back one of these days. But you see, there's no integrity. If it were, he would have paid it back a long time ago. Even if he paid it back $1 a month, it would have been paid back by now. But see, he doesn't care that he owes you. Because that's his life. His life is a dishonest life with no integrity. And there are a lot of people that way. Well, because now he's born again. Now he's a Christian. But you know, a lot of Christians are still immature, following the old habits, and they still don't have any honesty to speak of. I mean, real honesty. They keep the old habits, and they shouldn't, but they do. And so a person thinks, well, he's a Christian now, so surely I'm going to get it back to me. No problem now. He's a Christian. But don't be too sure. I've seen too many people go to church and get up and testify and do this that don't pay back their debts. My father talked with a person who was renting at his house one time. They rented to a part of that little place to rent, and they rented it during the wartime there on the coach house. And my father went to the Lord, and the man was, my father was his best friend. You know, he was so happy, and he came home. They were just bouncing with enthusiasm and the new love of the Lord and all of this. He was so happy and all this, his good friends. And his wife got sick and went someplace, and I think he needed about $175 or $200 to get her there. She had pneumonia or something. And my father loaned him the money, and only never saw him getting on the money again. But all of a sudden, the mail quits. All of a sudden, no more rapport with the person that's so much rapport. Why? See, what happens is, the person, he loses friendship, but they're ashamed to talk to you because they know they owe you. They won't pay you. And they're ashamed to talk to you, so the friendship's cut off and you lose a friend. And a lot of people have lost friends because they loan money. So don't ever, instead of giving loan, and don't loan anything you won't give. In your heart you say, I give it. If you don't want to give it, don't loan it. Don't be a surety for anything you won't give. Surety makes you a slave. It obligates you and often ruins your friendship. And there's a little truth here that's very hard for people to put into practice. But as the years slip by, you finally learn it. And how many here have run into a situation like that, and the person, oh, it was a policy, you were sure you were going to get it back, but you never saw it ever again. Have you ever run into that situation? Yeah, well, you know what I mean. You see, you don't help a person by taking all the load off of him. He needs to have that spirit of drive and necessity and integrity, and he needs to live up to his responsibilities. If you're ever going to learn it, you're not going to be a friend by... They float from place to place, hunting from friend to friend, so they never have... See, they just float around, the floaters. And they come into the church, you know, and the next thing you know, they got a handout. So you give them some, and I give them some, and he gives them some, and he gives them some, and he float off some other church, and they get some from that church, and off some, and get some from that church, and all they do is going around. And his sob story is so good, and you think, oh, you know, oh, I don't want to have a hungry stomach, and I've got money. So here it is, going to help you. You're not helped him. You're one of the many that are hurting him and keeping him from being a responsible citizen and learning to walk honestly and uprightly. You're not helping him at all. You're hurting him. He needs everybody to shut off everything from him and say, you're on your own. So he'll get out and get a job and work and quitting his job. We had a family like this, and we went him to Christ and began to help him. And we take him to church, and... One father didn't have a hand, and they felt sorry for him. They had a lot of kids, and we took him to church, and we gave him gifts, and I had a whole stack of children's records. We had a stack of that big. We gave him a whole stack of records, and at Christmas time, we went with a whole bunch of presents and took it over to him, and we led them back and forth, and they didn't have a father. See, he was off someplace, and so we got the boy a job roofing, and he was making good money, and he quit it within a week. So he could go up and put the money in and play these cars that go on these tracks, and they didn't want to work. And the only reason the husband left was so that she could get money because the husband left her. She needed to come back on occasion. And they didn't want a job. They weren't willing to work. They wanted handouts, you see. They wanted handouts. All right, then, on the end of that, this is a very practical lesson. It seems kind of hard, maybe, but it's the only way to help people. And then we come to the verse 6. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? And thou shalt arise out of thy sleep. Get a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. Now he says, go to the ant. Thou sluggard, and learn something. Look at the ant. The ant doesn't borrow. The ant doesn't beg. The ant works. If watch an ant. What do they do? If they get a burden that's too big, they divide it. If it's too big, you see two ants carrying the same burden. Have you ever seen that? Two ants carrying the same one. They travel along the same path, and if an ant is going along the path, and here comes an ant with a big burden, the one without the burden gets out of the way, and lets the one with the burden go by. And when the young are just like little tiny white pieces of rice, they take them, pull them out of the hole, and set them up by the hole in the sun, so it gets sun. If it rains, they take them and put them back in the hole, and they pull some little pieces of something across the hole. Then they make channels in the ant hills to drain off the rain that would come into the nest. And they store up food, and it gets wet, they drag it out in the sun, they let it dry out. They don't let it sit there and mildew, see? You think that's more sense than for some people. And they have a compartment, three compartments in the ant hill. One compartment where they live, they have another compartment for the food, and they don't fight over the food either, who eats the most and all of this. And another place they bury the dead, and they keep it clean. And they sleep in the winter, they don't need food in the winter, but they work in the summer in the heat. They work. When food's available, they're getting it. And they're busy getting it in. And so he says, oh, sluggard, he says, go to the ant. Sit down and watch the ant a little while. Learn something. Now, don't learn knowledge from the ant. He didn't say that. Learn wisdom from the ant. Learn the wisdom of storing it now. There's a true story of some men who got shipwrecked on an island. And they saved a big bag of wheat from the ship. And they said, well, we don't know how long we're going to be here. We better get this ground, better get some sticks and stuff and make some plows and get this ground plowed up and plant the seeds, because if we eat this, it'll be gone in 2 days and bread. So we better get it planted and kind of live off the island right now while it's still summertime. We got fruit and various things. And look, if it's planted, and then in fall, we'll have a harvest, and we'll have all kinds of bread and wheat we can store all winter long and make bread and clothes for next year. And so they got out and started doing that. But they sent a scouting party over the hill to find out what was inside the island. And next thing you know, we're wishing that gold was found on the other side of the island. Next thing you know what happened to all the farmers? Gold rush. Over the hills they were pouring, see? And they all rushed over the hills and feverishly began to get all this gold and dig for gold and so forth. And all summer long, while the wheat sat over here in Millville, they were plowing gold and getting gold. And then they came back with the gold. And they, every one of them starved to death that winter. Not one of them made it through. They didn't have any crops. They got gold. They lost the clear thinking about having to eat and provide for themselves. Got too busy. You know, getting gold. It's amazing how foolish that people can be sometimes. Now, even an ant will go out by moonlight. You see him looking in the moonlight to finish his storing, to get it in. But some people, they don't do anything. In 2 Thessalonians, chapter 3, verses 8 through 12. Paul says, I don't really like to preach messages like this, to teach you they're not happy messages, but I think, I needed to bring it. It's a practical lesson we need to learn. Neither did we eat any man's bread for nothing. But we wrought with labor and travail, night and day, that we might not be chargeable to any of you. Not because we have not power, but to make ourselves an example unto you to follow us. In other words, we've got a right, we've got authority, we have enough authority, you should provide for us, you should be doing that. But we're going to make ourselves an example to you to follow us, for you to do the same thing. For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. If he would not work, neither should he eat. For we hear there are some of which walk among you disorderly, out of step, working not at all, but are busybodies. Now them that are such we command and exhort you by our Lord Jesus Christ, that with quietness they work and eat their own bread. But ye, brethren, be not weary in well-doing. And if any man obey not our word but his epistle, note that man, and have no company with him, that he may be ashamed. Yet come not as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. And may I say, those of you who are in Bible college, if you've been put on credit in this school because you don't have a job and you're in a dorm or a house on credit, go to the aunt and see what he does and get with it. It's hard to get a job. Nobody says it's going to be easy. The thing is, you have an obligation. If you don't work, you shouldn't eat. And it's so easy just to freeload off of somebody else. And I am really quite embarrassed and ashamed to find that there are people who mull around the house and play the guitar and read the Bible, and they don't have a job, and somebody else is having to pay for them. They seem very content to have somebody else pay for them. And I've said it before, and say it again, that you're going to find yourself in very short order, if we don't follow this, you're going to find people who are having to say, all right, we've given you a chance, and you promised, and there's been integrity hasn't followed through. Now you're on your own. You're out of school. You're out of a home. We can't provide for you forever. You're going to have to learn to be a mature adult. So take heed to that. It's important. When I first came to this church, I worked for two years, never took a penny. In this church, I pastored for 2 years without taking one dime. We had a woman tell my wife, she said, well, I know why you're in this church, for the money. She said, my husband doesn't even take any money from this church. He works. From portal to portal, it was 10.5 hours a day. I was driving 100 miles a day back and forth to Everett and working full time and designing the church. And was working on that and teaching six times a week. And didn't take anything out of church. For 2 years I did that. And finally, Bible school came up, and I couldn't carry it on. You can't work and go to, and teach Bible school at the same time. I burnt the candle at both ends and the middle besides. But, and it was hard. It was hard, but much easier for me to say, well, get my salary out of here first. But we didn't have any money. We were trying to build a church. And so I was trying to get the church built first. And I still feel that there are times when you've got to get in and really dig and work. And God will bless you if you're willing to work. But if you want everything coming easy, then God can't do the same thing with you. In verse 10, that's the first bell, isn't it? In verse 10, yet a little sleep, a little slumber, and a little folding of the hands to sleep. And what that means is that's an ironical imitation of the sluggard. He's saying, come on, sluggard, go to the ant. And he says, oh, a little sleep yet. A little sleep. Just a little bit of slumbering. Let me just get a rest a little bit. A little fold my hands and sleep. Just a little rest, and then I will. See? A little procrastination. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth. You see, if you're always traveling, poverty comes to you. Because you pay that in, you pay it that in, you pay here, you're not earning, you're just paying. And pretty soon you're running out of money. And what you got left, the highwayman will take it from you as you round the corner, and you'll take what you haven't spent. Poverty should have come to you. But if you stay home and work, then you can build. And so there's some practical lessons here in the Bible. How many know there's some practical lessons, not just spiritual lessons? And so anyway, I meant to get past this point today, longer than I expected to. But if we pounded it home, many strokes drives the nail home. So, let's learn to be responsible, mature, upright Christians that are responsible for our own actions and not going around borrowing and lending and wanting people to give and people to provide for us. But let's learn to be responsible for our own actions, to get out and to work with our own hands. And now, there are times when a brother is down, and he's a brother, and he's close, and there are times when we do need to help out, and I'm not teaching that we shouldn't help a person when he needs to. But there's such a thing as to look and see there are people that you know that they hate to ever ask you for a thing. They'll go along with nothing in the refrigerator, won't say a word, and won't ask anybody for anything. That's the person you need to help. And he'll get it back to you as fast as he can. It's the first thing he'll get back to you. But there's some, you know, you'll never get it back. And they always need help, and they'll always need help. Those are the kind we need to quit helping by giving and start helping by leading them out and letting them to learn to become a mature Christian. Because, and here's my finishing statement, if we don't have industry and integrity in your mundane walk, you will find that that lack of discipline will carry right over to your spiritual walk, and you can't discipline yourself for Christ either. You can't get to Sunday school on time. You won't get your lessons or resources in time to give them. Nobody can trust you with any ministry. You're promised to vacuum the church, and Sunday will show up, and the church will be a mess, and somebody will be out here early Sunday morning, vacuuming like crazy, trying to do your job, but you didn't do it Saturday night. And somebody, you'll find out that all along the line, and finally people will say, well, we don't get that person because they won't follow through. We can't get that person. Don't let him teach a class because he won't research. Don't give him a class because he won't be done in time. Don't give it to him. He may not even show up. And pretty soon you find out that God can't use you like you need to because your integrity keeps you slothful all along your life. And so let's learn something from this, and God will bless us. Amen.